Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Polly Allen, who's most recently a principal product manager at Amazon, but has a wealth of experience as a software engineer, engineering manager, product management director, and product and AI coach. Welcome, Polly.
Thanks so much, Alan. Great to be here.
Glad to have you on. We have had great conversations before, talking about building product and building teams and building careers and all that kind of stuff. And when we were starting the show, you were one of the very first names that came to mind. I was like, oh, got to talk to Polly about this stuff. So I'm glad to have you on.
Thanks so much. I'm very flattered. Very flattered that I made the list.
Well, one thing, way that I find fun, I think makes a lot of sense to kind of ramp people in, is to let you give you a little recap of, you know, I gave that resume in a sentence of positions that you had, but like, how would you summarize kind of that your journey from, you know, starting as, well, as I characterize it, starting as a software developer, which is how I think a lot of folks start in product, and then to where you are now as somebody who has had this kind of broad and deep experience doing working on product? How do you kind of like recap that story for folks?
So I did start off professional life as a software developer. I always caveat with my experience with that those set of skills are not necessary or the foundational skills to being a product manager, because I think that's a big misconception.
Let's come back to that, because I think that's something a lot of people are curious about, that topic and that trade-off. So we'll get back to that.
100%. I know. I often say I know exactly how much of my computer science degree I do not use in my day-to-day. Hopefully that helps me help other people.
Yeah, that percentage just gets higher for me every week.
Exactly. I really did enjoy software development, though. I still miss it on the daily, and I really liked the deep analytical problem-solving work. But I also really liked the social work of figuring out how's my piece going to plug into this other piece, how does all the system design fit together. So that always led me, especially as an extrovert in software engineering, to talking to others, figuring out the plan, which led to a lot of people saying, hey, how about you help out on the program management side, on the product management side? And I always felt like after having built software for around 10 years, I got to a point where I thought I'd really like to be more involved with figuring out what should we build and why, and getting closer to the customer. So I transitioned from software engineering manager, over to product side, and I took a position with a friend's startup that was in the analytics space. So that was super exciting, and you get to be scrappy and wear a lot of hats. That's something that's common to a lot of product management roles as well. So I really like diversity in my day.
It's a startup life and product management life. So you're like double lined up there.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's where I first learned too, for things like sales enablement and marketing enablement and a lot of those other things that you don't have to do on the software side.
Yeah.
So I got thrown in the deep end. We did get acquired by a larger company in 2017. And I then moved on to come back to Amazon. I'd been a software development manager there, but I came back and joined the Alexa AI group. I've been really fascinated with AI and particularly NLP after having done a bunch of projects in the search space. I'd always thought that overlap of tech and linguistics is super interesting. So this was really a dream job as a principal product manager, helping to help Alexa understand what people are saying, but also help to make her smarter in all of her responses.
Yeah, I really enjoy talking to people. Obviously, AI is one of our current generation of the next big thing / current big thing in terms of exciting new technical change that's been happening over the last 5 or 10 years. But a lot of people have a bit of a tendency to maybe play up the role of AI, like, oh yeah, you know, it's like a spreadsheet with AI. Like, what exactly does AI do? It's
right.
Like, well, there's AI there. We told our investors there's AI, but no one would dispute that.
Exactly.
You know, when you're doing natural language processing and you're trying to get to the point where you feel like you're having a natural conversation with an assistant that understands what you're saying and can take thoughtful actions on it, it's like that's AI. That's, in my opinion, that's very, very clear application.
Exactly. It's very different. I've seen a lot of people just say like anything that's automation, like you're automating something is AI. You're like, no, that's not.
Is that,
that's not automation.
Is that AI? not to you know poke holes in other people's glass houses or whatever. But what was that like going in as a product manager? You know, I assume that like most product managers, you've come in with a background on software that you're looking at, buttons and lists and stuff like that, into a space product managing something where you're talking to it.
Oh, yeah. Moving from voice interfaces to visual UX to that sort of voice forward or multimodal. It's kind of the terminology we use because...
Yeah, it seems like you're going from like deterministic UI that you're looking at to like maybe non-deterministic non-UI, which seems like, I don't know, seems hard.
So I feel like there's two questions baked into this question, so I'm going to tease them apart. And one of them is the interesting piece of moving to working with voice as an interface. And that was one journey. And then the second one was what's different when you're using, you know, machine learned systems and how you work with those teams and how you do product management. So I'm going to tackle those one at a time because I think they're very different. For voice UXs or voice forward UXs, multimodal when you're using both the screen and voice, I was so fascinated to learn about it when I first joined. And a lot of companies like Amazon have training specifically for voice UX design because it's this new and emerging field that no one really has done before. The biggest problem with voice, you can probably guess, is really discoverability. That if you just put something in front of people and say, talk to it, they're like, well, what can I say? Like, there's no real easy way to make the features apparent.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then the second one is, you know, you have to be able to cover such linguistic flexibility to be able to handle ums and ahs and pauses and things like that. So that's where a lot of statistics are used to kind of say, okay, this sound is most likely, these three sounds in a row have an 80% chance of being this word. This word has an 80% chance of being meaning A versus the other.
Yeah, 80% though, it's like, oh man.
I know, exactly, right? So depending on the word there could be more or less certainty depending on everything from the accent and the background noise and the
mumbling.
Context it's used, mumbling, everything, right? Does the household have more than one language? People want to switch languages when they're talking to a voice user interface. So it's these models and multiple systems that go into just the understanding piece are incredibly complex. But then even being sure that the way you write Alexa responds is something that people are able to pick up just listening to audio, you read very differently than you hear. And you can't backtrack an audio. You can't go back and say, oh, it was the first sentence again if you weren't listening. So the words have to be simpler. The sentences have to be shorter. So it's a different style of writing if you're saying, Alexa, say the following things, than you would if you were, say, putting it in a UX on a screen.
Yeah, well, I feel that when working on podcast stuff, I'll write out a little blurb I'm going to say. And then I say that, I'm like, that doesn't feel the same when I read it. It sounded good.
Exactly. You have to hear yourself say it out loud. So it was interesting that this is a whole new field of design where people are learning, don't use the following words. They're too long or easily misunderstood. They're too easily conflated with words that sound pretty similar but have very different meaning, even when, because a lot of people speak back the same things they've heard, right? So it's all a really fascinating field.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So even if like they understand what Alexa said, and then if they repeat that word back and Alexa can't understand them, then that's a problem too.
Yeah. Exactly. And then when you have new words coming out in the lexicon, right? When the whole issue of Gabby Petito came out in the news, it was being constantly interpreted as potato.
Oh no!
So it's really complex problem that I found endlessly fascinating. So that's the voice UX problem, which is one piece in itself.
I've been trying to make a habit with this show of enunciating the word shipped. Like when we say it shipped that way, clearly. But I'm curious if once it's out in the world and people are trying to ask voice assistants to play the show, whether or not we end up with any verbal typos. But fingers crossed on that.
Exactly. Best of luck. I have a hard time getting the right podcasts sometimes on my voice assistant. but it could be an issue. There's so many of them, right? So disambiguating could be a problem. Yeah.
So that's the voice piece, which is fascinating in itself and already an interesting challenge. And then you're going into not only the deterministic, okay, we definitely are going to make Alexa say this thing, but now it's also then maybe it's non-deterministic how exactly this thing is going to get interpreted. There's these uncertainties, like you're kind of getting, oh, this is an 80% chance of being the sound or this word.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that was one of the largest shifts for me, was that instead of specifying the solution like you would in a deterministic way, where you're saying, here's the solution, let's make an algorithm that hits it, you know, and we're aiming for 100%. What the team is going to give you is you're giving them like an optimization function where you're saying, here's what we're optimizing for. We're optimizing for users continuing to say, yes, tell me more, or we're optimizing for them continuing to listen or overall playtime, right? So you're telling them the metrics, and this is sort of the language between you and the team. And then we're saying, okay, here's our hypotheses about what we think would help this metric. Let's run a bunch of experiments, but, you know, let's put forward, you know, and then the other piece is that, yeah, with it not being deterministic, you have to understand that, okay, it's only going to hit those metrics X percent of the time. How good does it need to be for it to be something that you're going to launch, right? So, and that's something where, you know, you're looking for comparable features, you're looking for at user expectations, and at what point do they just give up on a device if it's, you know, terrible too many times in a row? What does this mean for repeat usage? So if you try something and it doesn't work, your tendency is you're probably going to try it again. But once you've tried it twice or three times, eventually you're like, this just doesn't work and I'm never coming back, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So understanding user patterns in how many times you are forgiven, especially for new features when you're first learning user behavior, right? You often are saying, we need to get this out and we need to start collecting data before it's perfect. So it's a very different kind of process that you're not waiting for it to be. I mean, not that you do in agile software development either, right? But it's just a different, you know, you really have to look at the bar differently from, oh, this, you know, experience looked exactly like I prescribed versus, oh, it's meeting these metrics that I told the team we needed to hit.
Yeah, well, in some ways, that's been the progression of product management over the last 10 years in a lot of ways for beyond voice and AI, but like it used to be like, okay, someone is going to deem, you know, if you're unlucky, it's the Steve Jobs is sitting at the top of the org chart deem, okay, this is pixel perfect. Everything, every single experience has been evaluated, ship it and put it on CDs, to now we're shipping sort of dynamic software, even in the traditional software world, where we have a bunch of feature flags and A/B tests and metrics and subgroups and stuff like that. And so it's kind of interesting how we have so much more metric driven software development and less feel of like, no, this is good now. Okay, let's ship this experience to our users.
Exactly. And it is where both, one, I think there's a gap today in just like executive education, and they're in them understanding what they're getting into when they say, I want to leverage machine learning in our solution. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time they don't know everything they're getting into, right? And often they'll say, well, let's test it out. You know, we all know the data quality is the big important thing. Do we have enough data? Is it good enough quality? Let's do a proof of concept and just see if it works. And that's often very like the very first baby step on the journey, and they're expecting like, oh, we did the machine learning.
Yeah,
now we're done, right? We get all the magic.
Our CEO's exact voice is recognizable, therefore it works. Ship it.
Right, worked on his laptop now, not just mine.
Or worked that one time in the boardroom.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, worked in the demo. Obviously, you know, executives understand it has to work more than once, but that idea of, hey, we found the solution, it's only good 78% of the time, you know, if that isn't an acceptable user experience, and often it's not, how do we use like a human in the loop system or something to get this up to the acceptable quality bar until we have enough data to automate all the way, that kind of thing. So it's often like a longer journey than many people envision.
Yeah, that sounds difficult. You mentioned this kind of like data driven, like, okay, you're setting a metric and you're measuring, and obviously this is something we do for the most part across all product management and product leadership and engineering management, leadership, engineering leadership, is like trying to make sure that we're measuring the things that matter, and we're thinking about the data and how are people really using the product and what is working, what's not. But over the years, product development, product management has gotten more and more data driven, which of course has its strengths and weaknesses. And you kind of touched on some of the strengths, which is like, if you have something that works probabilistically, you can then measure, okay, how do we think it's working out in the field? What percentage of people are having this experience that they're coming back, and what percentage of people aren't, and based on the flags. But how do you think about the trade-off? Because like, obviously, you know, as we lose more and more of that, real human beings on our team are using this thing and it feels good, and we're actually engaging with it as a whole product rather than some metrics in a spreadsheet or on a dashboard, you know, we lose something. And so like, how do you think about like how to detect when the data is maybe wagging the product, so to speak, or is it just all data all the time? Like, I'm sure that's not your position, but like, why do you think about that trade-off?
Yeah, exactly. I do think it's really easy, especially when people first get into this, you're working a lot of the time with a lot of people who come from math and stats backgrounds, and everyone's like, give me the hard numbers, and that's the main thing, and how is this decision made, and if it wasn't made with numbers. But I think it's really important to look into, to maintain that sense of intuition. I will say there's a difference if you've one part of a very large system. It's kind of hard to have a full intuition if you've got like a system that's working end to end. So for example, just the piece of understanding what a word means, like which word did the user intend to use, right? You can get a good error rate on just that piece. But then you sort of overall, you've got, okay, did the system fully understand the intent of the user sentence and actually give them a response that the user liked, right? So one is end-to-end, one is very small. So the very small piece, it's often easier to use like the metrics and get that intuition of like, okay, this really is 98% of the time we do get the word the user intended or not. But that end-to-end, especially when you have multiple systems that are using, you know, that are adaptive, is where you really need, you know, okay, you've got the stats, but let's dive in and actually see if your intuition is correct on this, and if this still makes sense. So I think it comes mostly when you're looking at things holistically. I've got a great example from Alexa AI here. So one of the metrics that had canonically been used across the board to understand if users got the expected response is called bar generate. So really, did they immediately say no? Right?
Yeah,
I've done just, that. You know, that's a pretty obvious signal that you did not get what you wanted, right? But we had some features that were people were asking for topic based news and just saying, hey, you know, what's the latest on the hockey game? What's the latest on the Queen's funeral? And in a small number of cases, certain question shapes, we were launching just a radio stream.
Okay.
Just here's a live radio stream. It didn't actually have to do anything to do with the topic at hand. But the issue was that users are like, oh, it's the news. I asked for the news. This particular story isn't about the Queen, but like, is it just 5 seconds early? So they would patiently wait. Okay. and then eventually go like, and maybe they would even hear something interesting, right? So
that has nothing to do with what they asked for or...
Exactly. So our normal flags of like, hey, how are we doing on interrupt rate for this feature? If anything's got a terrible interrupt rate, let's go look at it. Wouldn't get triggered in that case. And it takes someone going, wait, this is super weird. I had this super weird experience the other day on Alexa. can we look into what's happening where we uncovered like, hey, there's this whole class of experiences that this metric doesn't cover appropriately because of user behavior.
And I think most people who worked on product, at least in product that's sort of on a larger team, it's not like from the 0 to 1 proof of concept-y stage, have encountered a metric that people use to make decisions, but then later you realize this isn't fully measuring what we thought.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Or at least not in all cases.
Precisely. Or exactly. The measurement somehow is broken is the other piece. We definitely had times where, especially when we're working with like the large language models and generating content, on one of our projects, we had asked annotators to verify not just, what's the fluency as like the metric of the output that, you know, these summaries of stories that we were generating, but how true are they? You know, what is the factual correctness? and how true are they to the underlying stories? And we were really surprised when very early in the project, we got back results that were saying like, yeah, they're all completely true and completely fluent. And we're like, really? Hmm. We just started this. I mean, maybe that's great. And again, I think the CEO hearing that would be like, great, ship it. sorry, CEOs. I don't mean to bang on you. Our fictitious idiot CEO that doesn't exist in the real world would say.
Yeah, the PHP CEO from Twitter.
Exactly. Once we, you know, took a look at this and said, let's dig in, we had found there were examples. One of them was a news story that was about how there's a new law in Finland that if you see a dog or a puppy or a baby in a car and they're overheating, you know how babies, dogs and puppies overheat in cars?
Yeah.
That you must break the window. This is a new law that you'll be fined if you don't help out. Sounds reasonable, except for when we looked into the underlying input, it had nothing to do with babies, puppies, cars, Finland, windows, like nothing at all. This is a completely made up story.
So like the AI hallucinated this news story out of like, and it was plausible because it sourced information about the world. You know, Sweden exists. This is a problem where babies get in a hot car and the laws get created. And so it like hallucinated this news story.
Exactly. So if you've trained a model on, you know, millions of news stories from around the world, it's like, wow, this really does sound like a law that they'd make in Finland, right? Hopefully I'm not being racist, pro or against Finland.
Nothing against Finland. We love Finland.
it just sounds, all of it sounds, especially when it's fluent and written in the style of a news story that we've grown up listening to, that's what factual reporting looks like. It was just incredibly believable most of the time.
So how did your metric, you ended up with a metric at some point that said, this story like checks out. Was that like a human being was played this and then human being said, like, did the AI successfully make a news story? And they're like, yep, it made a news story without like having the context to know whether or not it was a news story that existed?
Right. So the first thing we had done was given the news stories. We had given the articles as context, but we had found that they weren't reading them in depth. Mm-hmm. And so we had to create new tools that were actually like, here are the parts that were taken from the articles and from where, you know, and provide a lot more of that kind of almost like one step into explainability for the humans, for them to understand and be able to evaluate.
Yeah.
Right. Whether which part of this. And so that's where we could develop different degrees of factual correctness where you're like completely made up story versus they got the score of the hockey game wrong by one, which are the kind of errors that happen in the newspaper all the time.
Oh, right? Yeah, for so, sure.
So this, not to say that that's like correct and that's not the bar, but it was just interesting that like...
It's slightly less alarming than I'm completely manufacturing a law.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely. It's an interesting look at how, like, it's not just, oh, is this metric capture everything? But is there something broken in how we're measuring it? Is there a bug in the measurement system itself?
Oh, that haunts me. And maybe this is common for a lot of people in product roles, but like, I've seen over 20 years so many times, like, it doesn't happen super often, but it's happened enough times where meaningful decisions were getting based on a measurement that just didn't measure what we thought it did. Man, it sucks when that happened. Like we had an e-commerce product that had a metric that we thought was like, we were kind of interpreting it as like an indication of how many, what ratio of users had a good result. Like let's say how many, what percentage of people were checking out. But what it ended up being was actually the ratio of checkouts to users, right? So if one user had 10 checkouts, then they would count in this metric as 10 users having checked out. And that's really different. When on this product, we had a small core of really, really passionate people, right? But then the way the metric had been phrased in the dashboard made it seem like, oh, okay, well, we had a 20% checkout rate or whatever it was, or 70% or something like that.
Right.
It was like it was so high that the people were like, wow. And like, we're like, we gotta tell the board about how great this product.
Right.
It's like, we've really cracked this nut, right? But what it was like the ratio of checkouts to people rather than the percentage of people that had one or more checkouts.
Exactly. Especially the good news ones. Those are the worst when you're like, and every time there's like good news, it's almost unbelievably true. I'm like, okay, I now know, check that like 10 times, not just once or twice before you tell the board.
Yeah, those ones, and it's hard to be disciplined about that. And like one of the things that is an unfortunate kind of corollary of that is like, well, if it's really, really bad news, often you will double check. If it's like totally like, oh, our product is just completely going to be a failure if this metric is true, then someone will probably go find the bug. If it's like extremely good news, like too good to be true, then also probably, hopefully, if you're disciplined, someone will check. But there's a whole bunch of bugs out there in people's analytics out there, not to like, you know, give other people nightmares or pass on my nightmare, that are off by 20% or 10%. And they're just, there's this subtle bug that like, oh, in Firefox, it double counts or something like that.
And yes, it's just exactly.
Kind of screwing up the metrics a little bit, not to give you all existential dread.
But. Or the worst too, I find, is when you see something that seems really weird and unusual and you're like, I wonder what that's about. And you never really get a satisfying answer. And you're like, it's just weird.
You're like, yeah, it's a little bit, maybe some of it is contributed by this and some of it might be contributed by this. And you know, sometimes the analytics package doesn't get a chance to send off an event before they reload the next page. So we try to compensate for that. And you're like, yeah, I just unsettled the whole thing. But that goes a little bit back to what you were talking about with about explainability, right? Like when we build systems, especially way worse when you're talking about AI systems and systems with heuristics and learning systems, is if we can't explain and trace back where this result came from, then as product leaders, it's extremely challenging to improve it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And really diving into, you know, okay, how was this derived exactly? Let's map user action to the actual metric. And then please let's, you know, my intuition would say that this is higher than that. Like, it's just a really important exercise, I think, joining any new team to give you that real intuition of how these metrics were derived instead of accepting them blindly.
When we think about AI and all the new product experiments and startups and things that are being built over the last, you know, 5 years, especially around different new neural net applications and things like that. What is your response to the people that will kind of take a bare argument about AI and say, well, yeah, you can make these really impressive demos, but because you don't have that explainability piece on a lot of these packages, you know, you can create some teach some model, and then like 90% of the time it produces a good result and 10% of the time it produces like an offensive result or something like that. And then it's like, how do you get to that last 10% or last 1%? And the answer is kind of like I don't know, it's just a black box. Or at least that's the kind of argument some people will make against the general idea that, you know, we're looking at the next 10 years where AI is going to be doing more and more and replacing some of what folks would traditionally be doing and building kind of sort of more bespoke, sort of hand-tuned experiences for people. Like, what is your thoughts on that? Do you feel like something that's just something that is evolving, and from what you've seen that there are tools and ways to make it so that your product team can understand the AI, or is it kind of just a struggle?
So it's a huge area of research, and there have been some promising advances in explainability and kind of understanding the underlying model. There's just still such a gap, right? And I think part of it is, again, much like, you know, being a product manager, you don't have to be a developer. You also don't have to be a data scientist or a statistician, right? But we don't yet have enough people who are able to do that translation. And like, what do I need to understand from what the data scientist is saying to actually like how this is affecting or impacting the product, right? It takes a lot of collaboration with some pretty, you know, communicative data scientists who really understand things in depth enough to explain them, right? To be able to get to that point. I think overall, like, The piece that I think people sometimes miss out is when we hear about AI and we talk about the future, a lot of people go straight to Skynet and we're not going to have any jobs and like it's going to take over the world and the military will give it all the guns and we're all going to die. And of course that's, you know, that's the dark view of how things
that's
might go.
Worst timeline.
And then that's exactly, there's like worst timeline and then best timeline is much more optimistic. But even on the best timeline, I don't think we automate 100% of really most people's jobs, right? So instead of thinking about replacing jobs, it's more about how will the jobs change and what training do we need to provide people so that they have some idea of how do I think critically about what data this machine could have, right? So voice systems are trained on text And there's no way it could have been trained yet on people's inflection, on their physical interactions, their hand gestures, whatever, all the things we're not capturing on this podcast, for example, yeah. Right? That are actually 90% of communication, right? So I think there's a temptation when you see these systems to kind of personify them and think like, oh, if I can do that, I can do anything a human can do. But if you have that skepticism of knowing, okay, here's the limitations of the data that went into it, and here's about how often, you know, I can expect a perfect answer. And like you were saying, it's the other, if it's 90% is great, and then the other 10% is egregious, that's actually, I think that's more understandable for me as a human to help operate with this than if it's like, and 10% of the time, it's just barely wrong. Because then you have to really, you know, keep a close eye on it. But I think of it as more as like augmenting human intelligence and really like automating away. Often it's the parts people are just not interested in doing. I was talking to an engineer who works in sanitation, and she was saying as an intern, 90% of her job was watching these long, long videos of they'd put cameras and sensors down sewage pipes, and you have to watch hours and hours of video to see if there's any like tree branch intrusion into the video, into the pipes, right?
Smells like a test for AI to me.
Exactly. She's like, no one is sad if AI takes this job away from us, right?
Oh, the AI is taking the tree branch intrusion intern's jobs.
No, exactly. Exactly. So it's really interesting to take a look at, like, of course, which jobs, you know, will be partially automated, more than, you know, 80% automated. And there's different degrees in different industries. But I think there will always be a place for, there's just the context of the world that we are so far away from teaching a machine system about yet, right? There's a reason we still don't have fully automated airplanes, for example, even though we've had autopilot systems for how long, right?
Yeah, and the point about, I mean, this is, I think, been an age-old debate for hundreds of years, but we have advanced technology that takes away some things that people were previously getting paid to do, but then there's other things that we do that are like hopefully higher and better uses for our time. But one of the things that we already see starting to happen with AI, and there's going to be way more of it, is increase in consumption of the work once it becomes far cheaper. So this branch intrusion thing, like, yeah, maybe in this one sanitation company can watch branch intrusion in one certain place, but, you know, they don't have that many cameras. They're not creating that much video. But you can easily imagine a point where it's like, oh, okay, well, one of the standard things you do when you put a pipe down is you put a camera every hour off. And then the AI just like lets immediately anyone know if there's a problem, you know, like the scale can go way up because you can do it at just such better level. And so that, you know, in theory makes us better off because we have fewer water mains burst and wasting water and all these sort of things.
Right. Exactly. You're just like less cost to humanity on things. We really have better uses for that, whether it's brain time or money, you know.
And we'll just all agree not to give the AI any weapons and we'll be good.
That's right. As long as we break that in early and often, we should be fine. No nuclear codes.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to get back to one of the things you brought up at the beginning of the show, which was this question about, which comes up all the time in debates when you're building a product team, which is, to what degree do people need a technical background in order to lead product? I know you have the software engineering background, so you have that sort of like context, but then also, you know, now you're working in AI and things, which is something that I assume you were not learning in your CS degree. I did not do very much in my CS degree.
No.
About that stuff. There was, I think, one class basically. And so how do you think about that trade-off? You know, there's some companies that automatically say a product manager is must have an engineering background. And some leaders will say, as long as you have technical strength somewhere, you just need people that are people that can communicate. How do you think about that trade-off? Or I guess it's like a continuum of stances on product leadership.
It is a continuum. I do get very frustrated with the companies that just say dogmatically, oh, you need a computer science degree for certain positions. One, I've known lots of people who have come into programming from an alternative background who wouldn't meet that bar and who are amazing leaders, amazing product managers. And so that always just drives me a little crazy. But even if they say CS or equivalent experience, they essentially mean time coding. And I always think it's lazy because I think what they're saying is you need the ability to gain the trust and problem solve with tech teams. And we don't know how to interview for that.
They've had bad experience where someone comes in and then the tech team just writes them off as like, oh, this person doesn't get technology and they keep asking me to do impossible things and they don't believe us when we say something is or isn't possible or will or won't take a certain amount of time. And so they try to solve that by saying, oh, well, you have to have an SES degree.
Exactly. It's part of what motivated me to get into this space around tech and AI coaching for business leaders and product managers was that I had interviewed a lot of product managers who wouldn't pass the technical bar for, say, a product manager technical role. And it would drive me crazy because they would kind of say, but do you know where I should go? And a lot of them, I swear, left thinking they should do a coding bootcamp or something. And that's the only path, right? Or go back and do a CS degree. And you're like, there is this like 10% of knowledge. There's a thin layer of knowledge. And what that kind of gives you is also just the confidence that if someone throws a three-letter acronym at you, you can figure out what it is. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of that. There's a little bit of kind of gatekeeping that happens on tech teams where we like to throw around big terms and sound smart. So if you, especially if you don't have a team that has a lot of psychological safety and it's not easy to ask questions, people end up sort of going, oh, I guess tech just isn't my thing or not for me or it seems impossible to learn. Right. So that's one sad thing I see happening. But the other piece is that it's really more about empathy for the developers. And that's what, you know, a couple of years of coding would give you, right? Is really understanding how they think about these problems, the areas they feel misunderstood by leaders in business, and how you can get them on your side by showing that you do understand their concerns. You're not just ignoring them or dismissing them. And you're not just going to ask for impossible things and then be like, oh, you're bad developers because you can't do this impossible thing, right? I think that's the key piece.
Yeah, you can learn that stuff and how to have productive and effective relationships with the development teams without actually doing a coding bootcamp. And I've seen people who just did a coding bootcamp and became, you know, whatever, it was 3 months or 6 months or something, and still don't really have the level of thoughtfulness about what are the things that really frustrate a development team? What are the things that motivate a development team? What are the jargons and acronyms that come into actually like shipping software at scale? Meanwhile, I've worked with product managers and project managers that don't have a CS degree, but they have been in it for a few years. And then you can just kind of throw out like, okay, well, what is going to happen when we deploy? And then they immediately, the brain goes of all the sort of things that you might have to consider around, you know, deploying code to production or whatever, even though they've never written any code.
Right. Exactly. 100%. And I think a lot of it is that as developers all the time, we're getting up and we're drawing things on whiteboards to try to explain stuff more visually. And I've just seen people without technical backgrounds kind of freak out and go, oh my gosh, they're like speaking a different language. And part of it is, I mean, I know in school, we all learned some version of UML or some kind of like system diagramming, you know, timing diagrams. That's 98% of the time, that's not what we're doing. We're just drawing lines in boxes to explain concepts on the board. But it's really easy to freak someone out if they haven't come from that world and haven't seen that done or been through like the problem-solving process with someone where they're communicating that way. So there, but then if you've never done it, you freak out the first time you see it, you stay away from that side, you never get good at it either, right? So I think that's where in the coaching I encourage folks to kind of find their secret tech whisperer in their organization that they feel safe asking questions to, but at least have the understanding of your own systems at a super high level. Find a system architecture diagram and ask them to walk you through it to the point that you will understand, oh, why do we make this trade-off? Oh, it was for latency. You know, like the main concerns that you have in system design will really make you a better collaborator with the tech team.
Yeah, and you use that term systems design, which to me, I think is a huge part of the differentiator in between non-technical folks, or I don't even like the word non-technical, but folks without a CS background that can be really effective in some of those product conversations, and people who sometimes struggle, is the ability just to reason about the software as a system and on the parts that interact. And I saw this, I taught a couple courses at our university many years ago web applications, basically. And these are people in their fourth year of computing science, but I started talking about like, oh, okay, well, and the server does this. And when the client loads, I was explaining like HTTP or something like that. And then I could just see all the students and they're like, not all of them, but a lot of them, their eyes are just starting to go really wide or get really squinty. They're just like, okay, our brains are breaking. Or they would come up and they would ask questions afterwards that like, I realized I just completely failed them. Like they had no idea what I was talking about. They didn't know what a server was. They didn't know what a client was. And they're like, okay, so is my code like, I'm writing the code and it's on my computer, but then like it's on the internet. So like, what's the, and like the difference between code running in the browser and running on the server. And so like, and that's something you get more practice at teaching. I'm sure that you doing coaching on this stuff, you practiced how to explain that kind of stuff. But I failed like the first few times trying to like convey that.
It's very hard, especially I feel like as people with technical backgrounds, in some ways we're like, we're like the worst at this, because if you have had 4 years to understand it and it's all sunk in, it starts to become just like oxygen, right? And then you don't see that, you know. So I do my very best to meet people where they are, and I have had people that are just like, internet, is this ants marching, is this a power cord to my computer, what's happening? and that's totally great too. Like I think that's the other piece is people need to learn it's not a personal design flaw in yourself that you don't understand this yet. There has never been really great systematic teaching about this stuff. So how and where would you have learned this unless you felt like it was meant for you and picked it up?
Learning that stuff can really level someone up. Like I've seen folks in leadership positions just be way more effective because they can have conversations at that level. So I think that's awesome that you're doing that.
Exactly. And just the confidence. I think a lot of the time, a lot of them feel like they have to rely on other people to have and make those decisions for them. And of course, there's a good point to have delegation, but that ability to dive deep when you want to, it can also earn you a lot of trust with your team too.
Yeah. Well, it's way better saying like, okay, well, I don't understand anything you're talking about, but I trust you, to being able to have like a little conversation with them and then actually be able to trust them like at a layer below that, rather than just like, okay, you say so, servers, I don't know.
100%. And I think it makes people more comfortable going to them and saying like, hey, remember how we talked about this risk? We didn't, as opposed to be like, we didn't bring up this risk because we knew it might just blow your mind and you'd be afraid and you'd say no.
Yeah.
But it was like, okay, that risk, it did materialize. Sorry, you know, or like, now let's make a plan to do it, as opposed to trying to hide things. Or again, it's just that transparency can really help the teams be more effective more quickly.
Yes. You mentioned last time we were talking that you were working on a podcast. Is that related to this coaching work?
It is. Yeah, actually, I hadn't thought of... Oh, you're so good at this, Alan. You queued this all up and you've made a full circle. Way to go. Yes. The Tech Confidence Podcast is the name of the podcast. It's launching mid-November, and it's for business leaders who would like to work in technical companies or more closely with the tech teams, or even level up their effectiveness in a relationship with an existing tech team. If you feel like you know just enough to be dangerous, but less than you'd like to in those kind of technical discussions, this is what the podcast is about. It's also really trying to make some of the latest innovations from the metaverse and Web3 and AI more approachable, and find out where you can learn more things about them if it's an area you're interested in and think might, you know, your company or your team might benefit from you having a deeper background in that without needing to learn to code.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to checking it out. Sounds like something that may be some audience overlap between folks listening to this show and yours.
Well, maybe I'll have to have you on as a guest. We'll see.
Yeah, that sounds fun. I'd be happy to. Maybe I'll try to explain servers better now that I've been at it for a while.
Exactly. You'll be given another chance.
Awesome. So where can they go to learn more about your work and what you're up to?
Yeah, for sure. I have a website at humanintheloop.com, and also I'm at polymallen.com. So my email address is there on the website.
Awesome. Thanks, Polly. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm or at itshippedfm on Twitter. Until next time, keep shipping.